Hi, and welcome to the Newbery Chronicles. This is a podcast where two people read through every Newbery Metalwing book, and then we talk about it. My name is Michael.
And I'm Rebecca.
And it is late, so I'm sorry if I'm incoherent. But here we are, in the same month that we published the previous episode. This is a record for us that has not been matched since the golden days of early 2024, Rebecca. Anyway, today we're talking about the speaking of the early days of 2024, the 2024 Newbery Medal winning book, The Eyes and the Impossible by Dave Eggers. But first, Rebecca, as we've been doing since, I think, also 2024, we must talk about what we've been reading recently. And since this is not as big of a interval between the previous episode and this one, I don't have very much to say here. Do you have anything that you've read?
I do have things because the podcast that we recorded before, we didn't actually talk about things we had read recently.
That's true.
So,
which would be the best of our favorite of 2024 reading?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But I do have a few. I read The Hotel Balzar by Kate DiCamillo. This was her most recent book that came out in 2024, and it was a delightful story. It was very fairy tale like. It's about this little girl who lives in a hotel, the Hotel Balzar.
Is this like the sweet life of Zack and Cody?
No, it's not, because, well, sort of. Because in that show, which you never watched, so you wouldn't know.
All I know is it's kids living in a hotel.
Their mom worked at the hotel, and that's why they live there. And that's similar to this. Her mom was the maid and worked there. Oh. But this story feels very much like set in, I don't know, like Secret Garden times, or like that sort of like older world of children's literature where you like wander through hotels and find secret passages. Not like it definitely didn't feel
modern
day. You're
not like living
day.
In the Marriott or something.
No, you're not. Anyway, so they live in the attic. So that's what I mean. Like those sort of books where you're the maid and you live in the attic with your daughter. And her father has been off at war. We don't know what war. It's unspecified war. And she's just longing for him to come home. And there's this very old, very mysterious, beautiful countess who comes to stay at the hotel. And she has this parrot with her who used to be a general. And
the parrot
goes,
did?
Mm-hmm, he was turned into a parrot by a witch. Anyway, it's important in the book, but okay. It's not important for the summary. But that kind of tells you what this book is like.
I've never seen The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody, so for all I know, one of them was a parrot.
The only similarity between those two is that they lived in the hotel and their mom worked there. Just like...
It's a significant similarity.
Just like this main character. Anyway... So she visits this countess and she tells her different stories. And throughout the story, she's trying to figure out like what's happened to her father and where he is. It was just a delightful, delightful story. Kate always does it well, and she did it well again. Anyway, this book was very good. I read The Long Way Home by Louise Penny. I have been reading these books for a while, so if you're not new to the podcast, you already know this. This murder mystery actually starts out as not a murder mystery, and one of the main characters in Three Pines is missing, and so they're trying to find out what happened to him. And I found this book to be kind of a downer after the one I read previously, which was very good. This one felt very slow to me. There was a lot of talk about, like, paintings and things that I wasn't super, like, related to or engaged in. And I was very disappointed by the ending. But I'm still going to read the rest. I read Wicked by Gregory Maguire. And Michael has heard me talk about this book so much that I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. Except to say, I really did not love it. It took me a long time to come to that conclusion because I thought that maybe I was reading poorly, which I will say it took me a very long time to read this book because I kept putting it down to read other things. And that's not the fault of the book. It's just that this book is very thick, very involved. There are a ton of subplots. It's very much a fantasy book. I am not a huge fantasy reader.
We discussed earlier this week that there are three genres that Rebecca does not have a natural affinity for.
That's going to make me... Okay, go ahead. You can say
it. We'll leave it up to the listeners to decide what three genres those are.
Y'all already know I hate books set on boats. That Wicked did fine with that. There were few boats. I'm sure there were some boats. There's so much that happens in that book. I'm sure there are some boats.
Was there a second mate?
Here's what I will say about Wicked is that I think the main thing that I have frustrations about is I don't love Gregory Maguire's, the questions he's asking about humanity, which are valid questions, but I don't love everybody is in some way evil. Everybody is in some way, complicated in ways that aren't... Is everyone
in some way wicked, would you say?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it's in the title. You're so funny, let me tell you. I understand people are nuanced. I understand people are complicated. I don't love reading about characters that you don't actually want me to like when they're all like that. Jodi Picoult also does this. And I love you, Jodi, and I will keep reading your books because they're quick reads. They're engaging. But I don't know. It's something about... I just don't want to think of... I know every human has the capability of wickedness and evil, but I want to root for some characters, and there's very few that you can root for in this book. And anyway, it just was very, very involved. With one thing that I appreciated about it that bogs me down in other fantasy is there's not a ton of world building that you get lost in, but the alternative is that he just throws you in here and you're just supposed to figure out where all these places are. That was a little much for me. So I'm not telling you, readers and listeners, not to read it. I'm just saying I feel bad, but I don't think I liked it. Okay. And then I read The Bean Trees by Barbara Kingsolver. This book is wild. If somebody stopped you, Michael, in a town where you were just traveling through and said, take this baby, it's been abused, and then left you, your natural conclusion might be to call child services or something like that.
Yeah, I would immediately want that baby off of my hands because I didn't know anything about it.
But if you were the character in this book, who was a woman? In the 60s, maybe? I can't remember. Sometime before now. She didn't do any of that. She just took the baby and went on.
And it was a different time.
It was a different time where you just...
People elected...
Kidnapped babies and you didn't worry about it. So anyway...
Yeah.
But kidnap them for their own good and because you were told to do so. Okay. I actually really like this book. It's just the premise has pretty big questions out the gate. What are you doing? I think I said this is by Barbara Kingsolver. So Barbara is a naturalist. She is a fantastic novelist. She also writes a lot about, marginalized communities, and this one in particular is about different populations of people who have migrated to America with political crises in Central America, and about Americans' response to them here and their legality in being here and the lack of access to being here legally when they really need to be here for their safety, all very reminiscent of what we are seeing happen firsthand without support from our national government. So,
yeah, it's too bad the 60s were in a different time in that regard.
This was a very good book. It was very sweet. I really enjoyed it. It focuses on this relationship of these two women who are both from Appalachia, but... find themselves, I can't remember where they're living. I think it's California. Isn't that silly that I can't even remember that? It's been a while since I read this book.
One of those states.
And anyway, they find themselves I think that they're in California, but because they're both from Appalachia, they just think it's so funny that they talk the same and have this connection and just build a relationship together while this woman is also caring for this little girl. So it was very good. Even though I would have made some different decisions than this main character. And now, over to you.
So, I've read one complete book since the last time we had a discussion like this, I believe. Unless I'm forgetting something. And that book is by Ted Chiang, who is a science fiction and speculative fiction writer.
What is speculative fiction?
Well, so like, it's just the broader umbrella. You're like speculating about what things would be like if things were different in the world.
Okay.
So like, you know,
but
it's the term you use when you feel like the distinction between science fiction and fantasy is too limiting, you know? Like Star Wars, people call it science fiction because it's like space, but it has a lot of the trappings of fantasy as well, so you might also lump them under the umbrella of speculative fiction because they're all just imagining different, they're speculating about different worlds or different ways that the world could be.
So is like dystopian a like subgenre of that? Or you don't have
yeah,
to
yeah, I mean like a lot of dystopian novels are either satirical or sci-fi. I'm going to look up on the internet right now what speculative fiction is so we don't run into a polyglot situation. I was thinking about that earlier today.
You're still plagued by that.
How I misuse the word polyglot. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what Google says via Oxford Languages, a genre of fiction that encompasses works in which the setting is other than the real world.
Mm.
So.
Gotcha.
That could be anything. It could be Wicked. Or it could be the short stories in this short story collection by Ted Chiang, which is called Exhalation. So this is a book from 2019, although it's a short story collection, so many of the stories are from years prior. Ted Chiang is probably most famous for having written the short story that became the basis for the movie Arrival with like Amy Adams. And that's from a collection called Stories of Your Life and Others, which is, I have also read. Very good speculative fiction collection. This collection, Exhalation, is more recent, and it's also very good. Each of the stories has some like really interesting kind of like high concept like thing. What if you had a mechanical nanny, or what if parrots could tell you how they feel about the search for extraterrestrial life? Or what if you could peer into an alternate universe and talk to the alternate universe version of yourself? Or what if everybody was mechanical and their mechanical processes were governed by differences in air pressure? That all of these sound kind of silly, but the really cool thing about Ted Chiang is that he makes these stories and these outlandish concepts just really engaging, not just on a character level, but on like a philosophical level. Like he's really great at like taking a single concept and spooling out over the course of sometimes just a couple pages, occasionally over the course of what basically amounts to a novella. Spooling out like all the consequences of this one concept and how that might shape the world or that might shape a person's actions. And these stories were very good. And I really liked them. So if you like that sort of thing, if you liked the movie Arrival, if you liked his previous collection, Stories of Your Life and Others, then I would recommend Exhalation. It's very good. I've not completed any other books.
All right.
I'm in the middle of a few others, but that's the only one I got.
Good for you.
Well, better for you that you read all those other ones.
Better for me that I finally finished Wicked.
Yeah, I am very happy about that. That's been sitting on your bedside table for a while.
Guys, I just wanted to like it so bad.
Well, speaking of...
Because I'm a huge fan of the musical. So let's move on, Rebecca.
Speaking of liking things, yeah.
And we'll talk about Dave Eggers.
Dave Eggers, who wrote The Eyes and the Impossible.
Yes.
Tell us about his life.
Let me tell you about Dave. Okay, Dave has lived a life and is still really living it and is writing a ton. So I'm going to... There's so much on his Wikipedia page. It is just rife with information, which we usually don't have for our authors of the Newberries. So anyway, Dave was born... I say all that to say I'm not going to tell you guys a lot about his specific works because there's a lot. But he was born on March 12th, 1970 in Boston. And he attended the University of Illinois to earn a degree in journalism, but he was interrupted when both of his parents died. His dad in 1991, and then his mother in 1992. He was 21 years old at the time, and he ended up becoming the primary guardian of his youngest brother and moved to Berkeley. He began writing as a Salon.com editor and founded Might Magazine in San Francisco in 1994. At the same time, he was writing a comic strip called Smarter Feller for SF Weekly. Hmm. He is very well known for his 2000 memoir that Michael has read, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius.
It's good.
This was his very first book, and it is a memoir with fictionalized elements.
It also has a lot of like playful formal elements too, like footnotes, or like the copyright page has like narrative elements on it and stuff.
Cool. In this book, he is focusing on his struggle of raising his brother after his parents' deaths. He's written a ton of things. He's written many novels, short story collections, screenplays, essays, journalism pieces. He's known mostly for his literature and adults, literature for adults. Anyway, that came out weird. But I was really surprised at the list of children's books he's written. It's also extensive. Because when Michael and I saw that this was the new Barry, we were like, oh, must be his first venture with like children's literature. That is not the case. In addition to his works, his published works, he founded the literary journal Timothy McSweeney's Quarterly Concern.
And I had no idea that that was the full title of McSweeney's.
Well, it's not. That's just the journal. And then he also founded the publishing house that it belongs to, which is McSweeney's.
Okay.
He also founded this literacy project that's called 826 Valencia, which is a nonprofit writing and tutoring center for children. He founded the human rights nonprofit Voice of Witness, which uses oral history to illuminate contemporary human rights crises in the U.S. and around the world. He also founded Scholar Match, which connects donors with students who need funds to go to college. And on top of all this, he dabbles in a little bit of visual art. He took some visual art classes when he was at the University of Illinois before he had to drop out. But then he had a solo gallery in San Francisco called It Is Right to Draw Their Fur, which featured drawings of animals often paired with phrases, some from the Bible. It seemed like something that you would like to see.
I don't know, it just
sounded like just weird enough that Michael would like it. I hope you take that as a compliment.
I do.
Okay. And then in 2015, he had his first solo museum exhibition at the Nevada Museum of Art called The Insufferable Throne of God. Also sounded like something you would like.
Mm.
It didn't tell me anything about it, but I was like, that title, that sounds like Michael
O'Malley. I'm intrigued.
He met his wife, Vendela Vida. Isn't that a fabulous name?
Vendela Vida.
I'm probably saying it wrong.
Sounds like that Coldplay album.
She's also a writer. They met at a wedding in San Francisco in 1998, and then they married in 2003. They have two kids, just like us. So basically, we're the same.
Obviously. My art exhibit opens next week, if you didn't know.
I thought this was really sweet. He co-authored several children's books with his youngest brother, Toph, the same brother that he was the guardian for. They wrote this series called The Haggis on Whey World of Unbelievable Brilliance.
Dude has a way with titles, I gotta say.
So, in addition to all of this, like I said, he has written several children's books, 15 children's books, if Wikipedia is correct in their list. So that's just a little about Dave.
All right. Is it time to learn about the book?
Let's do it.
All right, so The Eyes and the Impossible. So this is a book that is told from the perspective of a dog named Johannes. This dog lives in what seems to be a very expansive park. I thought it was like a state park or something at first, and maybe it is, but it also seems to be some sort of city park because they talk about a city outside, of the park, and there's also like kind of municipal projects in the park, like there's an art museum that's being created and stuff that indicate that, I don't know, it's not really how I perceive state parks to be run. Whatever the case, this is a large park. Johannes lives free in this park, along with several other animals, and some of which are, there's a squirrel named Sonia, there's a seagull named Bertrand, there's a pelican named Yolanda, there's a raccoon named Angus, and then also importantly, there's three bison.
Did you talk about Sonia?
I said Sonia. Is it Sonia?
No, you're right. You're right.
The squirrel.
Yes, the squirrel.
Yes, I said Sonia the squirrel. I believe that was the first one I listed. Now, Rebecca, I'm going to need you to use your listening ears while I talk about this plot.
I'm ready.
Most importantly, there are three bison who live in this park for some reason. It's like a bison sanctuary as well as a park. I don't know. I used to live in the Memphis area. There's also a bison sanctuary in a very large urban park in Memphis. Or there used to be. In Shelby Farms, there used to be a bison sanctuary. Maybe it was a buffalo sanctuary.
Do you know, the part that I pictured looked a lot like Shelby Farms.
Unlike Shelby Farms, this park is also next to an ocean. At any rate, Dave Eggers, not Dave Eggers, geez, Johannes is just living free when the bison, these three bison, who are kind of like the elders of the park animals, they seem to be the oldest. They definitely are like the wisest and most cautious because, you know, they're bison. It's not like they can get away with a lot unseen. But they appoint Johannes to be the eyes of the park. And so he's going to run around and, like, observe everything in the park and, like, report back what he sees. One of the things that he sees is that in the middle of the park, in this, like, rotunda or platform, they've erected this art exhibit that has all these paintings. And he is really... intrigued because he's never seen a painting before, he's never seen a photograph, he's never seen anything but real things before, and so he gets very taken by this, and as a result is seen by some humans and captured, and then all the animals come and help him get rescued from being captured by these humans. But as a result, the park has this kind of heightened awareness of there's a stray dog running around in this park. And so Johannes has to be increasingly careful about his interaction with people because they now recognize him as a stray dog, but he also is really intrigued by these paintings. He wants to go back to the paintings. He causes more attention to be thrown his way when he saves a toddler from drowning. There's like flyers put up about him because his picture is taken or his likeness is made at some point. But Johannes wants to remain free. He doesn't want anything to happen. And he also wants all other animals to be free, too. And so what he starts to think about is, well, what if these bison were able to escape? So he and some other animals start thinking about how could we help the three bison, whose names are Freya, Meredith, and Samuel. How can we help them escape so that they're not in the sanctuary, trapped in the sanctuary anymore, and they can be free and roam out in the, you know, the plains. Around the same time that they're hatching this plan, a group of goats come to the park. It's unclear to me. Rebecca and I have talked a lot about like what the nature of this park could be. These goats seem to come around because they're like supposed to graze and like
eat the weeds,
which I don't really understand. Maybe people do this, but like, do they not have landscapers or something? Is this like an ecological alternative to having, you know, human, you know, groundskeepers or something? But whatever the case, this seems to be enormous pack of goats are brought to the park. One of them is named Helene or Helena. How would you pronounce that?
I said Helene in my head.
I say Helene too because Hurricane Helene was in my mind. Probably before Hurricane Helene, I would have said Helena. But whatever the case, this goat kind of befriends Johannes And Johannes talks about his desire to help the bison escape. And Helene helps him kind of think about this plan in which, like, the bison could escape on, like, in the herd of goats. Like, the goats could basically, like, camouflage the bison by, like, jumping all around. But what is also revealed in this, something that Johannes did not recognize, is that the park is on an island. So if they want... He somehow didn't realize that. And so if the goats will go on a boat to leave the island. So if they really want the bison to escape, they got to get the bison on the boat with the goats. Johannes is, you know, they come up with this big scheme to get the bison on the boat. And then at the last minute, the bison realize, you know what? It's really nice that you have this plan, and we really enjoy the ways in which this plan has given us the opportunities to think about the ways that our life could be, but really, we think we're just going to stay here. And Johannes...
But they're so thankful to have seen the sea.
Correct, right, because they do start to escape.
Yeah.
And so they're out of their pens, and they see the sea, and they think, that's enough. Like, my life is full enough. I'm going to go back to my pen. But Johannes... thing is invited to go instead on the boat. And so Johannes is like, wow, I could go.
There's a whole chapter in which he says, I could go.
Right. Those words are written over and over again for like 3 pages or something.
Mm.
And so in the end, Johannes leaves with the goats and lives to be free out in the wide world. Also, two things that I couldn't fit in that summary organically, but that are also big components of the book. At one point, Johannes discovers that he is not a pure dog, he is also crossbred with a coyote. And so that is kind of a crisis of faith for him. Not a crisis of faith, an identity crisis for him, because he's been thinking of himself as a dog, but now he's part coyote as well. Also, Bertrand the seagull. The seagulls in this book, and I'm saying in this book because I could not find any evidence of this happening in real life, but seagulls in this book, when they are wounded and might not be able to fly anymore, basically commit suicide by flying up into the sky really high and then just dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And Bertrand...
It's their final flight.
It's their final flight.
And it's considered this big honor and like a very beautiful thing amongst the seagulls.
Everyone else is kind of like, what the heck?
Johannes,
and to be honest, that was a little bit of
indignant.
Me too.
Indignant.
So anyway, Bertrand gets injured... I believe
when either a fool.
Yeah, he's like flying in front of these archery ranges. This park also has archery ranges. He flies in front of the. He likes to fly in front of the targets and like dodge the arrows, basically. And he gets injured as a result of that. And so he's going to make his final flight, and Bertrand basically talks him off the ledge. Or excuse me, Johannes talks Bertrand off the ledge.
Mm-hmm.
That's right in the midst of them trying to help the bison escape. I didn't know how to fit it into the summary otherwise.
Yeah, and so then Bertrand ends up going with Johannes.
Right.
To the mainland.
Yep.
One thing I will say about him being a coyote, this actually puts him in danger after he saves the toddler. I don't think you mentioned this.
I didn't.
Okay, just want to make sure. Since I wasn't listening at the beginning, I wasn't sure if my listening
was on point. You've done a
good
job. You've course corrected, Rebecca. I'm not going to have to send the note home now.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So when he saves this toddler, it's obviously a very heroic thing. No one else has seen this baby fall in the water. He saves her. But once he does, he is very visible to the people in the park and the park rangers and all the other people there. And so then there's this hunt for this coyote because they feel that, like, oh, he saved this toddler, but he's a threat because he's a coyote. And so I think his crisis of faith is also tied up in, I thought I was someone who was safe. I thought I was someone, you know, like a being that was safe, and that I stay away from people so that they can't, like, control me or change my life. Because he does get kidnapped very briefly in the beginning.
Right. I did say this part. This is when you weren't using your listening ears.
Okay, so I think, like, the change of identity for him is, like, I thought I was a safe creature, and now I'm hunted in a different way, not because I'm wanted for, like, to be their pet, but because they see me as an enemy. And so I think that's where the crisis of faith comes in. So anyway.
What did you like about this book, Rebecca?
I thought it was a really sweet book. I thought that at first I was like, oh my gosh, I gotta read to the perspective of a dog. But I thought...
Animal protagonist for one of the stories that Rebecca said she doesn't inherently
But I like this.
There's also a boat in this book.
But they don't spend any amount of time the sea.
There's not port and starboard.
Listen, I have no explanation. Leeward. I have no explanation. I get really worn out when they will describe every part of the ship because I do not care. I want to know where you're going and I want to see you get there.
Rebecca doesn't like animal characters. She doesn't like boats and she doesn't like...
But let me talk about...
She doesn't like fantasy, which is why The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is Rebecca's favorite Narnia book.
Gosh. Freaking Reap Cheap. You don't like Reap Cheap either. Okay, I'm moving on. So, I like Johannes' voice. I thought it was very clever talking through the voice of a dog. Like, he will use this really exaggerated language. Like, a minute is 7,000 years. Obviously, it's very similar to, like, your impatient toddler, but, like, they're always happy and energetic about the next thing. So, I thought that was really cute. I thought it was really well done, very clever through his voice. I thought this book was really intriguing. It was fast-paced. You don't get bored or bogged down. Like, it moves very quickly. I thought that some of the prose and the internal dialogue was really strong and very on point. And I just think it's really interesting because when you use fewer words because you're talking through the voice of a dog who's going to be simplistic and not waste things and not be flowery.
You mean like a smaller vocabulary?
Yeah, like smaller vocabulary, but also like not waste time in saying what he's thinking. Like he's going to say it quick with maybe not as many words as you'd have in like a lengthy paragraph. But in the simplistic voice of these animals, I think that Dave Eggers does a really good job of not wasting words and saying things very poetically and beautifully through the voice of these animals. And I thought that was really good. I don't have like specific phrases to bring out right now because I didn't look those up beforehand, but there were parts where I was very moved and I was like, this is really interesting how he's able to do this in this very short, succinct sentence without like wasting any time in a really nice way. So I thought that was really, really good. I thought that the human's relationship with the park and the land is really interesting, and how the animals and their relationship to the humans, like, they just cannot exist on the same terms in the same space. They can't fully engage with one another. Johannes, even as he saves this baby, he's still a threat to them, and more so a threat to them after this heroic act that he's done. And like, even though the animals in some form, I'm thinking specifically the bison, they kind of exist there as some sort of entertainment for these people, but they can't fully participate in the other forms of their entertainment, like the art gallery and experiencing those things on the same level. So I just thought that dynamic, we don't hear a lot from the humans, like barely at all, except for like the people at the beginning that like take
Johannes.
Who are
very unpleasant, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, just that dynamic, and I thought that was really interesting. But that's what I liked.
I also liked the prose. It's my turn. Yes. I also liked the prose. I thought it was like really inventive prose. I feel like sometimes on this podcast, definitely more in real life, I often complain about the limited scope of like prose in children's books, particularly modern children's books, which oftentimes seem like they kind of have settled on like everyone's writing in the same voice. I would say this is especially true of YA. I think I made this very critique of Free Water,
mm-hmm.
Which was the other most recent Newbery Medal winning book that we read. Last year, 2 years ago?
It won the year before this one.
Right. And this is a, like you said, a very inventive and oftentimes very, like, stunningly narrated book in prose that is, like, appropriate for children. It's not like oh, this is a book for adults that's just like sneakily like dumbed down for kids. It's like, you know, makes sense that a child would want to read this, but it's also a very creative, you know, engagement with like language on like a level that a child and also a dog, like it makes sense. I really like that. Another thing that I like that you didn't mention, I thought you were going to mention it, but the format of this book, we have not mentioned yet. This book is illustrated, and the illustrations are these paintings that all have Johannes running through them. It's like these landscape paintings with like a dog.
Like famous landscape paintings.
Yeah, yeah. So I was looking at these because they don't really correspond to what's going on the page. And so I was reading the book. I was like, I wonder what's the deal with these. These are lovely paintings. And then you get to the end of the book, and these are pre-existing landscape paintings, some of which are kind of famous, where the illustrator has, rather than paint the whole scene, taken this painting and then put the dog in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like almost all of them are just the dog running through the thing, through the, you know, the painting. And I think it does like a really great job of like expressing the kind of like core thing that is animating Johannes throughout most of the book, which is his love of movement and his love of freedom and his desire to be uninhibited. And just seeing this dog like just sprinting through these like, you know, gorgeous, you know, natural settings, I think really evokes like the spirit of the book in a really great way, even though I was initially confused at like the pictures not having any connection to what I'm just reading about. So I really like that as well. What didn't you like?
Really what I didn't like were more questions that I had that I felt were unanswered. And that's one of the things that I was mentioning is like, I know this is a newer recipient of the Newbery, which means that people aren't talking about it as much. There's not as much conversations. But I just had a big question about the setting. Like, where is this place supposed to be? I couldn't think of any like island where there would be this like big urban park within it. It just seemed like he was writing about a specific place that I didn't know where it was.
It did seem very point, like some of the details seem so pointed.
Yeah.
But it does kind of feel like it's an imagined location.
Yeah, but it also felt like it was based off of something. And so I was just curious about what his like inspiration for the setting was, but I couldn't find any conversation about that. I didn't read any like interviews about this book or anything. But anyway, so I had questions about that. I too wanted to know why the goats were there. I mean, their presence there is essential to like the plot, but other
than
that,
the goats are a perfect example of why I want to know what this park is,
right?
Because that's such a idiosyncratic specific thing, and yeah. Like maybe it's supposed to be kind of surreal, but also it feels like it's a reference to something, yeah. And I can't figure out what it's a reference to.
And then there's this note in the beginning that I found it just kind of be irritating, like, as you read the rest of the book. I'm just going to read it to you guys, if I can find it. It says, "This is a work of fiction. No places are real places. No animals are real animals. And most crucially, no animals symbolize people. It is a tendency of the human species to see themselves in everything, to assume all living things, animals in particular, are simple corollaries to humans. But in this book, that is not the case. Here, the dogs are dogs, the birds are birds, goats are goats, the bison.
Which is why they talk like people.
All that is true. All that is true, except that these animals are anthropomorphized throughout this book. So I just felt like it was kind of like, what is the point of that note? Like,
it's a very Dave Eggers type note.
Okay. Well, I've never read any of this.
Yeah,
this is
kind of like self-aware, like, ride.
I just thought it was kind of irritating. It was like, okay, then write a book about animals, but you didn't do that. You wrote a book about animals, but they're clearly having the same like feelings and emotions and thought processes as humans. I thought it was a really clever endeavor, though. I don't. Oh,
I almost cute, wonder. The little phrase clever endeavor. Clever endeavor. Bars.
That's what this book
Greg
is.
Greg's mixtape dropping on that piff next week.
What?
It's the mixtape website.
What did you not like? That's what I didn't like.
Well, hold on. Let me. Okay. I'm actually gonna.
You gonna challenge me?
I'm not gonna challenge you exactly, but I wonder if it's meant to. You know how at the beginning of Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain has that note where he's like, anyone trying to find the moral in this will be executed, and anyone trying to find characters will be shot, and like things like that. Like, you know, which is funny coming in a book like Huckleberry Finn, which is maybe the most like thematically ambitious book like he had written up to that point. I wonder if it's almost like that, where it's like, obviously this is what you're going to do. So I'm going to write this little joke of a note that is
another more joke bars. Of a note. Look at us.
It's a slant rhyme too.
It's.
What did I not like about this book? I don't know. I feel like I could be convinced that this isn't the case, but I kind of felt like after having read this book that it was style without substance.
No,
I really liked the style of the book, as I just talked about. I found myself caring not one bit about these creatures and not really understanding why some of the things were the way that they are. I know that things can just be whimsical and not need a point, but some of these things, I just was left wondering, like, why is this here? The seagull suicide.
Okay,
I truly don't understand the seagull suicide. It's a pivotal, like, linchpin moment in the climax of the book, and I simply don't understand why it's there, and I left not understanding. Yeah, go ahead.
That is a part that I forgot to mention that I liked. I was also like intrigued by that from the very beginning. Like, they introduced this idea about the seagulls,
it's Chekhov's seagull suicide,
the beginning
for
of
sure.
the book, and Johannes always has a big problem with it. He's like, I don't find this honorable. I don't find this beautiful. Even if you can't fly, you can live. Like, just this, it is so frustrating for him because he doesn't get it. And he loves Bertrand. Their friendship and that whole subplot is, I think, one of the most beautiful parts of the book. When Bertrand is injured, he's got this wing injury. He's crying. And that's another thing. Johannes is so annoyed with him at his, like, this sounds like a pun, but his flippancy, like with the archery, just like his flying
flat,
in the
sea.
I just meant he'd
be the record doing... show. It's almost midnight when we're recording this.
I just meant that he'd be doing flips in the sky to try to avoid. Anyway, Johannes is also very frustrated with him about that. And so, like, you see it coming when he gets injured. You see all of this coming. So when he's injured and Johannes leaves him alone, I was like, do not leave him alone. Do not leave him alone. At literally and figuratively his lowest point. Like, I knew it was coming.
It's about to be his highest point, though.
And so when they can't find him at the end, and Johannes goes to him, and he stops, and he has this beautiful moment. He was like, you know, I didn't really want to die. I just thought that's what I had to do. And then he goes to live this other life with Johannes. I thought it was beautiful. And I just think it shows what can happen when you have people in your life, or animals in your life, friends in your life.
They're not people, Rebecca.
That's, I know. Dave told me they weren't. That, you know, will show up for you and say, this is not the only way. And you have more beauty to bring to the world. And let's go experience this beautiful thing together.
I think it's like, for me, they make that point at the beginning of the book. It's like, why are these seagulls committing suicide? No one knows. They just like doing this. And at the end of the book, the seagull's like, yeah, I guess that wasn't a great idea. Like, it feels like a joke because it's so tossed off. But, I mean, this is like a mass, like, suicide. It's like, I don't understand the format in which it goes. There's no epiphany. Johannes doesn't change his idea about it. All he does is talk him down from killing himself. There's no, like, we see Bertrand undergo a transformation there, but Johannes doesn't. Like, it's the exact same point he makes when we first hear about this. I don't know. I just don't understand. I understand how it could be a beautiful moment, but a lot of it just, I don't know, the structure of it just feels strange to me. it feels strange to me the way that, like, whether it's a surreal element or not, like, the goats are introduced, and the goats just make fun of Johannes all the time, but then they also make fun of Helene, and that's why Johannes and Helene connect, which is fine, but I don't really understand the goats. Like, I don't know. I want this book to either be a lot more surreal than it is, so I can know to just be, like, content with, like, weird stuff is happening, and it's, like, on this, like, other plane of existence where, like, kind of stuff can happen and you just kind of roll with it because it's about the vibe. But a lot of it is very, like, materialist and, like grounded. And I don't know. I just really struggled finding an emotional connection with it. And while I really liked all the prose and the draw, like, the paintings and all of that, by the end, I kind of was like, okay, I feel like I've been put through like a carnival ride of a book, but without, like, I come out at the end at the same place I came to at the beginning. Like, I don't feel like I've been taken on a journey. I don't feel any closer or more insight about these characters than I did at the beginning, because I don't have a good idea of these characters. I don't know. Like I said, maybe I would reread it and feel differently, or maybe you could change my mind about this, but I just had trouble finding resonance in this book.
I feel like it's a book a lot about identity, and, like the hope of what you see is not all that there is, you know? Like, that sounds like something that we would talk about at church, but, like, I literally feel like I pulled that from a teaching.
Maybe.
But I do feel like it's this idea of they're in this isolated place that for Johannes at one point he thought was his entire world. It was his entire world, and he thought that that's all there is. He is astounded to find out that they're on an island and that there's this place called the mainland, and that the bison knew about this all along and didn't tell him. And then to find out that he's a coyote, and he thought he was just a dog, and he thought that he was just this, I don't know, like, really friendly animal, but that was also completely free. He didn't have any of the inhibitions that other pets had, like, what a silly thing that they would have clothes put on them and all these things. And then Bertrand with, like, well, I'm a seagull, so this is just what I'm supposed to do, but really there's this whole other world out there that I can live on the ground. And maybe Bertrand will be miserable, you know, with, like, we've not read the sequel to this. There's not one. But I'm just saying, there could be. There's, like, a whole other story to be told about their new life together. But I don't know. I just felt like it was a book about possibility and what your identity can be and what it doesn't have to be. Like, it doesn't have to be contained to this one thing.
I think that's lovely. I didn't get that out of the book. Maybe I would if I reread it. Yeah. I don't know. There's not really much else I have to say. I feel bad, like, poo-pooing this book, because there's a lot of elements I like about it. And maybe I even just like it a lot. I don't know. I also am a big proponent of things can just be aesthetic experiences, and that's okay. Yeah. There doesn't have to be a bigger point, which I did like the aesthetic experience of this book. But I just...
Another thing, yeah. I liked, one more thing that I liked.
Go for it.
To help you as you make your decision. I thought the raccoons were really funny.
Because the raccoons
are always, like, these, like, mischievous creatures that have thumbs so they can help you, like, do stuff that you can't do as, like, animals. But they're always, like, they'll go along with what you say, but they're not always, like, they don't want to show that they're on board with what you say, because they need to be these, like, they just reminded me of so many annoying people that I've met in life, but you also need in your life, that will, like, help you get the job done, but they're gonna, like, I don't know about it the whole time.
Be on a podcast with you. And speaking of animals, though, one thing I also did like, and I thought was funny, is for seeming with basically no explanation, every other animal just hates the ducks.
Yes.
And thinks the ducks are the worst. And I don't really understand. They don't exactly elaborate on it, except just like, oh, of course the ducks wouldn't help us. And like,
they're like the librarians in Parks and Rec.
Yeah, and like, I don't know. Like, that's just, that's funny. Like that, because you don't think of ducks as, you know, these malevolent creatures. Although, ducks' mating practices, very bad.
Really?
Very bad. Yeah.
You had to educate me about that later.
Don't imitate the duck mating practices.
And like when they ask them for help, they're just like, oh, at what time? Oh, sorry, we're going to be dunking. We're going to be dunking at that time and coming back up.
Putting our heads in the water.
Which also reminds you of really annoying people that aren't actually busy, but they don't know how to inconvenience themselves for the greater good. Like that, those are the ducks, okay?
Yeah.
Those are the ducks.
Duck and responsibility.
So here's the moment of truth. I give this book a thumbs up. What about you?
I think that
I want to remind you that you gave Strawberry Girl a thumbs up.
I don't even remember Strawberry Girl at this point. This has been like 2.5 years ago or something.
We poo-pooed that book way more than we poo-pooed this one, and we still gave it a thumbs up.
I will also remind myself that I gave Free Water a thumbs down because I said,
this book is a better book than Free Water.
I'm tired of skewing positive when I'm really just fence-sitting. And so,
this book was better than Free Water.
I think this feels like an American Idol where everyone's kind of waiting on like Simon to do his. And
Paula's already given her thumbs up.
You're Paula for sure. Maybe even Randy Jackson here. And here I am, Simon Cowell. I don't know. This is also part of the problem with the binary system where.
Once you said, I give it a thumbs up, but if the wind blew a certain way, it would just fall right over.
I mean, that maybe is a good answer. Also, it could be, I give it a thumbs down, but the wind could blow it a thumbs up. I don't know.
Okay.
I think just to be interesting, I'm going to say thumbs down since you said thumbs up. But it's a very, very, very weak thumbs up. It would probably be a thumb sideways if we were allowing that.
Well, I think you're a harsh grader.
Maybe.
You know, the saddest part of this podcast is now we're back in the 1920s.
We are next time in the 1920s. Maybe it'll be good. I don't know.
It could be.
We've not yet had a book that we liked from the 1920s. But, you know.
Surely there's one.
There's always. Tomorrow is always another day. So next time, we're going to be reading the 1929 Newbery Medal winning book, The Trumpeter of Krakow by Eric P. Kelly.
So it's basically in the 30s.
Yeah, I mean, the market was probably already crashing by that point, right? Like,
right.
Hopefully the Great Depression didn't tank children's literature like it tanked the economy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's what we'll be talking about next time. If you want to weigh in, if you know where The Eyes in the Impossible is supposed to be set in real life, you can email us about that.
If you want to tell Michael the ways that he's wrong, email us about that.
I love being told that I'm wrong.
Just tell me that I'm right, but you can tell him he's wrong.
Yeah. So if you any sort of feedback you want to leave us, remember you can email us at newberrychronicles@gmail.com. Newberry has one R. I feel like I always have to say that because I always do two R's and have to correct myself. So let us know. You got anything else, Rebecca?
That's all I got.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you guys in the 1920s.